Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I've got some interesting new science to discuss today, a fascinating email case, and just off the top, I want to tell you, I don't plan to talk about the convalescent serum story that came out on Monday unless someone calls or emails specifically wanting to hear about it. We will have, however, a science lesson explaining immunity in here if there's time. But, you know, I'd really rather talk with you and answer your questions and help you. A lot of people may be listening to this program from a different location than they normally do, and my heart goes out to all of the people who have had to displace and evacuate. The air quality is still very poor, so all of the advice that I gave last week, and that show is up in case you missed it, all of the advice that I gave last week about minimizing your risk in this air is really important and still quite relevant. Just, again, remember, plants, particularly ferns, are very good at cleaning the air, probably because back when ferns evolved, there were massive amounts of volcanoes and sulfur vents and all kinds of stuff, making life on Earth a competitive challenge. And I guess it still is. So let's launch into some good news. And my first story is about physics. This is a recent study. Researchers who study the viscoelastic properties of compounds. Viscoelastic is basically, well, viscosity, you all know what that means. And elastic is stretchiness. So if you want to think about what would be something highly viscoelastic, think about rubber cement. As soon as I was reading this article, I immediately remembered playing with rubber cement as a child, making a glob, rubbing my fingers together, and then seeing how long I could get that stretch. And many women may remember that as a fertility test, actually. The viscoelastic properties of cervical mucus change during the menstrual cycle. And after ovulation, you get what's called fertile mucus, which has high viscosity, and you can get like an inch of stretch between your thumb and your fingertip. And that tells you that you've got a highly viscoelastic compound. It also looks different on under the microscope, and so we can identify that particular change quite well. Well, these researchers were thinking I'm about the vibrating tools and the spinning tools in the dentist's office and how they turn water into mist and send it flying into the air. And of course, if the mist contained a virus or other pathogen, then it's a health hazard for dentists and patients. This paper was published, I should say, in the Physics of Fluid by Alexander Yeren and his colleagues. And they were thinking about dentist drills and going, I wonder if there's anything that could be done to change the viscoelastic properties of this to reduce the aerosolization. So they began studying already FDA-approved food-grade polymers. One such polymer is called polyacrylic acid. And they used a very small amount, and they added it to the water that's used in the drills and the sprays in a dental office. And what they found was wonderful. A very, very small mixture of these polymers completely eliminated the aerosolization. So not only did the admixture of polymers completely eliminate aerosolization, but it did so with ease. So this is something in polymer physics called coil stretch transition. And it worked beautifully. So they looked at polyacrylic acid, as I've mentioned, and they also looked at xanthan gum, which you'll find in a lot of salad dressing because it works to thicken the salad dressing and acts as an emulsifier. Both of these have high elongational viscosity, so it's very elastic when it stretches. And it also has something called a low shear viscosity, which means it doesn't plug up the pump. So they did one experiment in the lab, and it completely proved the concept. It is so easily and completely capable of suppressing aerosolization by dental tools. And the elastic properties were even stronger. So basically, in the baseline situation, the spraying mist that comes from the drill and the cooling of the drill causes water to burst into tiny droplets. And we talked about the mask study last week, how tiny droplets, you know, maybe not good. The polymer, when it's used to irrigate, suppresses this. So just irrigating and then drilling, the polymer macromodules, again, molecules, they act like rubber bands. Remember that rubber cement analogy? So when a little bit of, when the vibrating tip sends something into the air, because the polymer solution is stretchy, it acts like a bungee cord, and it threads into these little snake-like bungee cords that pull the droplets back towards the tool. So the pure water doesn't exit. It can't reach escape velocity, which I just find unutterably cool. The droplet tail stretches and it gets sucked back into the mass, sort of like the fact that water in different situations has high surface tension. And you can do things like have those little insects that I was so fascinated with as a child that walk around on water, and drops of water can cling to the edge of a dropper, right? We all see that. That's surface tension, a physical property of water that gets broken when you vibrate it, hence the problem with the dental tools. So I thought that was worth leading with, and we're going to move now to another science story. And this one is about something called antivitamins. Now, antibiotics are among the most important discoveries of modern medicine. They've changed the world. It's been almost 100 years since the discovery of penicillin. And like most things, we overused it for a while. And now we have a problem with antibiotic-resistant bugs, because bacteria are alive and they can evolve. And that's a problem, because our antibiotics select for the evolution of resistance. Now we're reaching a problem where we have severe problems with multi-drug resistance. And those are unaffected by most antibiotics. And some things that used to be quite curable have become difficult to cure. These researchers were thinking outside of the box. They are at the University of Göttingen and the Max Planck Institute for Biophysical Chemistry. And they have produced a new approach to killing bacteria called antivitamins. This was recently published in a journal called Nature Chemical Biology. I might add, this was actually a peer-reviewed study, because it didn't get through, it doesn't show the need to be published emergently. What is an antivitamin? Well, they're substances that inhibit the biological function of a genuine vitamins. Some antivitamins have a similar structure to the actual vitamin whose action they block or restrict. So for this study, the professors looked at an analog, a naturally occurring antivitamin of B1. This is thiamine. Some bacteria produce a toxic form of thiamine, which interferes with its functioning as a protein cofactor, which is what many vitamins do. They sort of help enzymes work, and these they allow the enzyme not to be destroyed and to keep working. This particular antivitamin has only a single atom in a different place from natural thiamine. It seemed like a very unimportant place, but because of this phenomenon where bacteria are creating their own antibiotics against competition, they decided to study it. They used a technique called high-resolution protein crystallography, and they did this to investigate how the antivitamin inhibits important protein from the central metabolism. And what they found was that the movement of the functioning proteins, the so-called dance of the protons, completely ceases to function. It's just like putting throwing a wooden shoe into a factory machine, the origin of the word sabotage, or putting a stick in a gear to keep it from turning. It is extremely effective. Now, here's where it gets better. It kills bacteria, but the human proteins that we have that require thiamine do not bind to the antivitamin at all. It doesn't interfere with them, so they don't get poisoned. This means that antivitamins could be used to target bacteria, and in a way that it's very unlikely that the bacteria could ever evolve resistance to, since it sort of stops them on contact. It's very hard to believe that they could revamp their enzyme to avoid this. So I'm very excited about that. Our first email this evening comes from Tracy in Seattle. Tracy's subject, chlorine gas poisoning. This is, by the way, parenthetically, audience, a most amazing cautionary tale that provides a lot of fodder for discussion. So I hope you will learn something as well as understand the dilemma that Tracy in Seattle finds herself in. Greetings, Dr. Don, and thank you for your time. My mother used bleach in her apartment to disinfect a wooden rocking chair that was outside. She lives in North Carolina, so the windows were shut and the air conditioning was on. The fumes were quite strong, so she opened the window and then thought, well, maybe if I rubbed the chair down with vinegar, it would help dissipate the bleach smell. Okay, so let's talk about using bleach to clean. Bleach and acid don't mix. Vinegar is also a good disinfectant. They are both pretty good against mold spores, but when you put the two together, you get something seriously toxic, and that's chlorine gas. Chlorine gas, you know, the thing that got outlawed by the Geneva Convention after it was used in World War I, and it was quite the innovation then. That's why all those World War I doughboys, you see them wearing gas masks. Gas warfare is a bad idea for a lot of reasons. Okay, but don't do gas warfare at home on yourself, and that's what happened. As you can expect, she immediately started to suffer from the effects of chlorine gas poisoning. Airing out the department didn't seem to get rid of anything. She lived like this for almost 3 weeks until her breathing and heart rate became so bad she sought medical and maintenance help. I'm going to stop and make another parenthetical statement. Okay, yes, we are in a COVID epidemic. Hospitals are not that bad a place to be. I can only speak for our own hospital, but the number of COVID cases is very, very small, usually around 4 to 6 people, and they've identified them, everyone who is even suspected of COVID and has a test waiting, who's in the hospital, is treated as if they had COVID. And we have another story later on this episode that talks about why that's good and how effective the things that they are doing in the hospitals are. But realistically, people are dying in droves. In Italy, the rate of fatal heart attacks doubled in the population in northern Italy. And it doubled because people didn't come in for their chest pain because they were afraid of catching COVID. Well, you can't do that, all right? If you're having a heart attack or you have pneumonia from some other cause, or you're suffering from vomiting blood or something like that, you have to get medical help, okay? We have a whole healthcare system that is out there. What we don't want is we don't want to flood the hospitals with COVID cases, which is why all of the measures that we're taking exist. In places like Turin and Milan, Italy, early on, they did have a problem because they had so many cases that some kid with a motorcycle accident and a head injury might have died rather than getting the neurosurgical treatment he needed just because all of the ventilators were already being used for other people. We don't have that situation anywhere in the state of California, to my knowledge, and I believe that I'm correct. The state website indicates that everybody is getting the ICU care that they need. So I've got, you know, don't be foolish. But I think that's what this lady did. She was so afraid to go to the doctor that she actually sat in there and breathed chronic chlorine gas for 3 weeks. When she finally got someone in there to clean it, they used something in the vents that, quote-unquote, smelled like citrus, possibly something with limonene, which I have read could be carcinogenic, only compounding her breathing issues. A mom was stifled by this scented substance, so the maintenance team used ozone to dissipate the lemon smell, and she continued to try and air out the apartment, but the Clorox smell continued to return. She actually had to move out of the apartment. Needless to say, the whole ordeal has been exhausting to her. She doesn't have that many friends, and most of the people in her life are elderly and vulnerable. Every time she's re-entered the apartment, the smell is stifling. She's called a company to come to the apartment to access what needs to be done to clean out the smell, but she's hesitant to trust them for fear of something becoming worse. The company that suggested a cleaning protocol said to use only water to clean the carpets, wipe down walls, and wipe down ceilings. Mothers read that water can reactivate harmful fumes from particles created by the initial toxic mix. She's exhausted, confused, and doesn't know how to move forward or who to go to for help. Not to mention, she's terrified of having to go to the hospital due to COVID. She's seen a doctor and seems to be getting better, but is awaiting some blood tests. I fear this could lead to further lung issues due to her overactive immune issues, eczema, allergies, rashes. She actually had to move out of her previous home due to being allergic to the heavy metals from the well water. She was not able to bathe. Now this. Long story short, can you suggest a direction or a company to turn to that may know how to deal with this type of environmental cleaning and also a protocol of how to heal her lungs and health going forward? She is planning on getting an air scrubber that hopefully will be able to help and some houseplants to clean the air. I fear that due to her sensitivity, she will not be able to return and be homeless for a while. Unfortunately, this is not the only problem she is faced with apartment living, which is probably not where she wants to be in the first place. However, considering COVID risks, it's not really a good time to move, even if her health were perfect. I am all the way across the country and am not able to just pop by and help. I feel so helpless, not to mention she doesn't feel comfortable jumping on a plane to come and live with me. I fear for her exhaustion, physical and mental health. She's lost any stability in her environment at one of the worst times possible. Thank you for all that you can do. Your show is such a wonderful part of my life, and I appreciate everything you do for your fellow man. Well, Tracy, my heart goes out to you. Your mother clearly has upregulated Th2 cells. That's a type of T-cell-mediated immunity that causes the beta cells to make lots and lots of IgE and makes people very hypersensitive. And she's had some environmental sensitivities issues, and now she has lung membrane damage. So this is a tough nut to crack. I don't know the circumstances. If this were a condo and she owned it, my advice would be pull the carpeting up, and I don't care what's the flooring. Pull the carpeting up, scrape, you know, get rid of the carpeting, get rid of the padding. And, you know, wear slippers so you don't get splinters if it's subfloor. But if she can't get the landlord to agree to that, she has to get out of there. I don't think that the water is such a bad idea. And it's summer. It's probably really hot. But I'm worried that if you used water to clean the carpeting, you'd have to clean the carpeting and let it dry multiple times. And I'm worried mold could get started because you're in the humid heat area. In Arizona, I'd probably try using water to clean the carpeting and basically just let it evaporate, go back in there, leave the windows open, let it evaporate, go back in there, wet the carpeting, leave the windows open, let it evaporate, you know, throw some fans in there and see if you could dilute it down. But really, getting on an airplane is safer. There are some airlines, and I'm not sure if Delta is still doing this, but they have only one seat per row, and everyone is, checked for fever and, before they get on the plane and not let on if they have it, and the airline attendants are all wearing masks, and so I feel like that could be an option for you. You could also, I don't know what your financial situation is, but you could also consider buying a block of seats just to keep, make sure that there's no one in directly in front of her, directly behind her or next to her, and put her on the aisle or on the, probably on the window would be safer. Although she's probably going to want to wear a diaper. And definitely I would stay out of the bathrooms and just pee my pants if I were flying right now. And, you know, maybe you get diaper rash, but small enclosed spaces like those bathrooms do not seem to me to be a good bet. If you decide to take the airline route, speak with a human at the airline, explain your situation, get the name of the person you speak to, and tell your mother if she gets on the airplane and she doesn't have the space around her that she needs, get off the airplane and then fight for your money back, you know, because you were assured by so-and-so on such and such a date at such and such a time at such and such a phone number that this would be okay. And you will probably get your money back from the airline because they don't want that. They do not want the publicity. And they really did commit to keeping her safe. So let's talk about healing. She's currently safe. She could start work just leaving the windows open and hoping that the chlorine smell eventually evaporates. I would leave the windows open. Unless, of course, you know, there's a hurricane and then you have to, someone should go close them for her. You don't want that carpeting getting wet with rainwater or hurricane water, especially. What else can I tell you? We're going to talk about things that would help with her TH2 testing. Now I'm putting on my, I need to specify, I'm putting on a functional medicine speculation hat about what might help. And I will qualify it when I have data and where there is science to back it up. And some of it's just good common sense and some of it's functional medicine lore. So let's start with that which has scientific support. If you look at treatments that have been suggested for and have shown benefit in experimental models of chlorine gas, one thing jumps out, and that's N-acetylcysteine, or NAC. Now, this is sold over-the-counter as an oral nutrient. It increases glutathione levels. We use intravenous NAC for people with Tylenol overdose because it protects the liver. And in functional medicine, you can use inhaled glutathione, which is actually the thing that N-acetylcysteine turns into. That glutathione inhaled into the lungs is very good at helping heal membranes. And if N-acetylcysteine works, that means that the rats had enzymes that could convert it. My bet is that humans do too. And you can get inhaled N-acetylcysteine. It is a pharmaceutical. It is available in the appropriate form because it's used to help cystic fibrosis patients loosen up their mucus. So this is an actual drug that could be prescribed by an actual doctor. Your mom needs to see a pulmonologist and get some pulmonary function tests and see whether or not any of her pulmonary function has been impaired by this. It is possible that she could have dysfunction. She could have water on the lung. She needs to be evaluated by a pulmonary professional. So please have her talk to her primary care doctor about making that referral. That really needs to happen regardless of what natural measures you take. And honest to God, if there's one office I would trust to be able to keep you safe from COVID, it would be the pulmonologist's office. Okay, moving on to other natural medicine things. For her overall hyperreactivity, and this is, she's not allergic to chlorine. This is terrible. Chlorine gas is a terrible irritant. But there, I'm going to give you the three things that the TH2 people need to be taking. One of them is high-dose vitamin D, about 5,000 units a day. And by the way, there is preliminary data that helps protect you from COVID. people with the higher vitamin D levels pretty much across the board, and this includes nursing home patients and other vulnerable populations, do better than people with lower levels. And, you know, that's a reasonably solid data, even though it isn't placebo-controlled, because when you go into the hospital, they've got your blood, and they know what happened to you, and they can check what your vitamin D levels were because they keep your blood. So I feel like that's not a coincidence, and the data, I think, is good on that. Probiotics, particularly Lactobacillus rhamnosus, is excellent for using, for mitigating the TH2. I recommend a dose of about 10 billion CFUs, and that's been used in children at that dose, children with eczema and asthma, very safely, and has helped their symptoms. There's also a bioflavonoid that's found in apple skin and onion skin. It's called quercetin, and this, a dose of about 1,000 milligrams, also has pretty solid data for reducing allergic symptoms. The other thing I would say for your mom is some preventative things. Why does she have this? Why does she also have environmental sensitivity? And is there a problem with her mitochondria? We do something called organic acid testing. For that, you would need to take her to a functional medicine doctor. You could put her zip code into the website at the Institute for Functional Medicine and find someone nearby and call their office and bounce this off them and see if they thought they could help her. A lot of those doctors are not seeing patients. They're just talking to them on the phone. With the pulmonary tests done, I think that would be a very legitimate way to go. Other things that have shown some promise in dealing with more acute chlorine gas exposures are nebulized lidocaine, that's the local anesthetic, breathed in, and inhaled steroids. So that's where why I wanted to see a pulmonologist if she decides to stay. We want to reverse some of the damage. We're going to continue with our science roundup. Our next article is a new technique to speed up nerve regrowth for trauma patients. This comes from the University of Alberta. So let's talk about for a moment what happens in trauma. About one out of 30 people who is in any kind of trauma gets a crush injury of a peripheral nerve. And this is a problem because those nerves are keeping the muscle active. Have you ever seen someone in a wheelchair from, let's say, polio? Or if you haven't seen that, perhaps someone from a spinal transection where the spinal cord was completely cut. You'll notice that their muscles virtually disappear. I've seen this also in advanced ALS patients. If you don't get a little ping every second or so from the motor nerves in the spine, just kind of, hello, hello, stay alive, don't die, then the muscles actually disappear. They actually die off. On the other hand, people who can't walk for other reasons but have intact peripheral nerves, let's say someone with a balance issue who becomes wheelchair confined, while their muscles don't get kind of flabby, they don't atrophy in the same way because they're still getting what's called tonic stimulation. So when there's crush to a peripheral nerve, you really want to get that nerve reconnected as quickly as possible. So these researchers found a treatment that increases the speed of nerve regeneration by 3 to 5 times. The researcher, Christine Weber, an associate professor at the University of Alberta's Anatomy Division, said, "We use the term time is muscle. If that regrowing nerve can't get to the muscle fast enough, you're not going to get a functional repair. You'll lose effectively too much muscle tissue. The slow nature of nerve regeneration, it has to go all the way back to the spinal cord and grow, and it grows basically at about 0.5 millimeter a day. So it takes a long time to get to your foot. But that's where conditioning electrical stimulation comes in. This process, CES, involves electrically stimulating a nerve at a fairly low rate," and I just laughed when I heard the rate, 20 hertz for 1 hour. A week after one CES treatment, nerve surgery is done, and the nerves grow back 3 to 5 times faster than if the surgery was done without the CES. They've been working with animals, and recently they performed a distal nerve transfer in which the donor nerve, which was going to be basically unhooked from its target site and transferred to the damaged muscle, was electrically stimulated. And then a week later, a branch of that nerve was cut and it was placed near the target of the non-functioning nerve. And the newly transferred nerve was primed and ready to regrow, and it grew into the muscle at a much faster rate, and it prevented foot drop. So this idea that a certain frequency of electrical stimulation of the nerve is capable of turning on DNA and making it grow faster is one of the basic premises of electroacupuncture, which I have been practicing now for, it blows my mind to think of it, but, you know, it's true, 20 years. Different frequencies of acupuncture have different effects on the nerves. If you're trying to have an anti-inflammatory rate, you use 15 to 20 hertz, which I thought was a wonderful coincidence. Healing any kind of painful nerve, you'll often use 15 hertz and 4 hertz. So it's like the 4 hertz is kind of nurturing and the 15 hertz is anti-inflammatory. And when people have an acute injury, like a burn or a sprained ankle, there are certain points that if you treat them fast enough, at least to my observation as, you know, someone with 30 years of medical practice, you don't get nearly as much swelling, you don't get nearly as much blister formation in a burn, but you've got a short time window, a day or two, where you can really make a difference in how much inflammation. Once those inflammation DNA cycle gets turned on and starts churning out prostaglandins and inflammatory proteins, you can't turn it off very easily. You know, it's kind of like chalking the tires of a truck so it doesn't roll down the hill. You can do that. So I was quite impressed with this, and I can't wait to see where it goes from here. We're now going to talk about immunity a little bit, just a general science lesson. So we're going to talk about developing immunity, and of course the concept here is to viruses in why this article got published. There was a story Monday that I think led to this article being written up, and that was about the news that scientists in Hong Kong had confirmed that a 33-year-old man was reinfected with COVID-19. And he was reinfected at airport screening about 4.5 months after his first infection in March. So he got a light case. This is coming out of Hong Kong. He got a light case of COVID-19, and then he cleared his antibody, and then 4.5 months later, he wanted to fly to Italy, and it was there that he was found to have positive antibody test. So that was in the news. I don't have to tell you any more detail about that, except that the second case was completely asymptomatic, which I think is relevant to this discussion. There are several important epidemiologists who contribute here, and I'm going to try to give them credit as we go through. A coronavirus researcher in Galveston named Vineet Menachari lays out a kind of pattern here. There are 4 possible scenarios for how human immunity might go and where we might go with this virus, as well as future viruses that might happen. And he frames it in terms of 4 categories: sterilizing immunity, functional immunity, waning immunity, and lost immunity. Sterilizing immunity is that once you have the immune system armed against a foe, it's able to fend off infection forever. It's kind of once and done. And usually the diseases that will cause this are diseases that are very, very infectious. And a good example of this in measles. most of the time you only get measles once, and the measles vaccine is extremely effective. This is great, and we'd love it to be true, but it is almost never true for viruses that infect the mucous membranes of the nose and throat, which, of course, is all of the cold viruses, which is why you don't just get a whole bunch of colds in kindergarten and never get colds again for the rest of your life. There's also a phenomenon that we see in medical residents and in parents that I think is very germane here. Ask anybody who teaches in a grade school, and they will tell you the first year they were teaching, they had a cold constantly because they were exposed to all of the myriad, I think there's supposed to be like 25 different cold viruses, and four of them are coronaviruses, which I think is quite relevant here. The sterilizing mandate would be great, but it's probably not going to happen with a case of COVID, and this guy is evidence that it doesn't. But the question is, well, if an infection with COVID doesn't trigger it, there is some reason to be concerned that a vaccine may not trigger it either. And most of the experimental vaccines, when used in primate, protect the lungs from the severe disease when they're basically giving it to monkeys and then exposing them to COVID. We're seeing that they don't get severe disease, but they do get virus in their nose and their upper airways. So we are primates. It's a good bet that that's how a vaccine would work with us. But that's not so bad, because we're not worried about getting COVID. We're worrying about getting dead. And if we get mild cases of COVID, then it's basically the way that the cold viruses are. You're good for a couple of years, and then you can catch that particular cold again. And I have some data further on about that. We'd like to move now to functional immunity. And this is what Menanchari thinks is the most likely. People's immune systems are primed to recognize and fight the virus, whether through infection or vaccination, and they could contract it again in the future, but these infections are going to be cut very short because they've got the memory cells and they've got T cells that recognize the virus, and so they will start fighting it immediately with their adaptive immune system, which causes much less destruction than the innate immune system, which is kind of nonspecific and blows the IL-6 levels sky high. But the T-cell immunity doesn't do that. T-cell immunity is also really good at fighting viruses. So even if you can't find antibodies, you have persistence of T-cells that can recognize and fight this virus. So people either get a mild cold or no symptoms at all. And my own personal experience was exactly parallels to this. My intern year, I had a cold constantly, just like the grade school teacher. After that, and for virtually the entire time that I was seeing my typical 20 to 30 patients a day in my office, I might get a mild, I'm coming down with something feeling, and I would go heat up my body in a hot tub or take a long hot bath and go to sleep early, and generally the next day I was fine. What was I doing? I was heating up my blood, because viruses don't reproduce well. That's why you get a fever. It's actually a natural defense. And so I was giving myself a fake fever, and then giving my immune system just a little time to climb on top of it and go, oh yeah, I know you. Here, zap. And it worked. That's really a good start, is hoping that this fellow in Hong Kong is actually showing us what we can expect. And this is the most likely scenario. Now, it is possible that the people who get a second infection will be asymptomatic and therefore not be producing that much virus, and so it will reduce the R naught. Now, there's another situation we probably want to mention. If you're a young child, we know that young children are less likely to develop the disease first, and there are some reasons to believe that this is how influenza immunity is also working, and we haven't even really clued into this. And children who get the virus when they're very young may end up getting infected as their immunity wanes, but those infections are very unlikely to lead to severe illness even when they're elderly. Now, this is a probability statement, but it's a guess that if you were sufficiently infected to induce a long-lasting response, then that's going to ward off severe disease in the future. And that, I think, is a really, really optimistic thing. Now, I mentioned I wanted to talk about the influenza in this context, because in the 1970s, there was a bad influenza. It was called the swine flu. It was pretty epidemic, and many, many people got it. And then fast forward to 2009, and one of the research things that came out there was that people who had been exposed to influenza or gotten swine flu, now, of course, it's 30 years later, so if they got sick that year, or they even were, you assume that they were exposed, even if they didn't get sick, what was found was that they actually were very resistant to the next time H5N1 came along, and that was in 2009. That was the flu that led Mexico to shut down its airports for 48 hours, which was a brilliant move and pulled a lot of cookies out of the fire, probably averted another 1918 flu scenario for lots of reasons. And I strongly recommend, if you want to learn more about this, John Barry's book, The Great Influenza. It covers this hypothesis very, very well, and it's a great and interesting read. There's a possibility that people may have what's called waning immunity. They actually lose their protection over time, and they don't have any detectable antibodies. This is where this is a 30-year-old study, and they were looking at coronaviruses. A year after deliberately infecting a small number of volunteers with 229E, which is one of the coronaviruses, they brought them back, and two-thirds could be reinfected if they gave them a long enough time, like a couple of years. But when they were reinfected, they didn't shed virus for very long, and none of them got a cold. In a very ambitious study, this is more recent, Dutch researchers followed 10 healthy individuals for decades, measuring their antibodies to the human cold coronaviruses at periodic intervals. And periodically, there would be rises in their antibodies, which were evidence of recent infections. And most of the subjects had multiple infections with each of the viruses. Studying this group, what they found was the median period between reinfections was about 30 months or 3 years. But the antibody levels had dropped substantially as soon as 6 months post-infection. And this is not a peer-reviewed, so they probably wanted to put it out fast because it's optimistic and we could use some optimism when we talk about this. Now, the last possibility is total loss of immunity. And, you know, all dogs are pretty much alike. They have four legs and most of them have a tail. So it's unlikely in the extreme that the immune reaction with coronavirus, this one, is going to differ substantially than all of the other known immune reactions to coronavirus, at least once we get some immunity going. So I'm feeling, after reading this article, a little bit better. Moving on in our discussion of immunity, we've got a few minutes to continue. So I thought I would talk a little bit about this amazing dance between the B cells and the T cells. So the absence of antibodies doesn't mean, as I said earlier, that you don't have immune memory. Obviously, I referred to the fact that there's cross-reactivity. We know that from studies that were placebo, or not placebo, you can't have a placebo COVID, but basically in studying the antibodies that were found in patients post-COVID infection, they had a fourfold increase in antibodies that also cross-reacted with these cold viruses, the other coronaviruses that have been circulating in the community forever. So what that tells us is that they're close enough for the antibodies that some of us may possess to cold viruses to be somewhat protected. You now know what neutralizing antibodies mean. There's a study going on right now where they've taken serum from people who had antibodies against COVID, and they're creating monoclonal antibodies, and that's very exciting. I see we have a caller, and so I'm going to interrupt myself, but I certainly want to reach out to Moose Hello, Moose, and welcome.
A friend of mine has a nerve disease, and it's called peripheral neuropathy.
Peripheral neuropathy is how we say it. We like to be fancy. Yeah.
It sounds much better the way you say it. And I was just wondering, he's a doctor over the hill, and he's in charge of the COVID wing of the hospital, and he got this about a year or two ago, and he went off all white stuff, you know, sugar and flour and a lot of stuff. And now he's feeling a lot better. He feels better, but he still has this, I guess it's a disease, right?
Mm-hmm. It's nerve damage. And is he tall? Is he really tall?
He's pretty tall. He's 6 feet.
Okay. So peripheral neuropathy is more common. It's in the feet in those individuals who have that risk. But basically, the nerve has, you may not realize this, but the nerve in the spinal column, its nucleus is up there in the spinal column. That nerve is a bundle of single cells. And if you're 6 feet tall, your legs are probably 36 inches long. So you've got a 36-inch nerve, and all of the nutrition that has to go 36 inches. And so the tips, if there's anything that compromises the nutrition, we're going to start with nutrition, the nerve will die at the tip. Just like if my watering system goes out, if my drip system goes out, it's the tips of the branches that die, right? The root, the plant's smart enough that it just drops its flowers, first of all. And so that's what's going on. So there's two things. There's B12 and folate. And most doctors, if you would check their B12 level, and they'd check their folic acid level, and if those were fine, they would say, okay, that's not why I have it. What they need to check, and you can, tell them to listen to this program. You just go to AskDrDon.com, because I'm going to talk real fast right now. He needs to check homocysteine and methylmalonic acid and make sure those are both good. If either one of those are high, he has a common mutation, and he needs to take methylated forms of these vitamins because the standard multivitamin will not work for him, and that may have compromised his nerve cells. The other thing he needs to do is think about heavy metal exposures. Does he have a lot of mercury in his mouth? Has he been exposed to a lot of lead? Did he do a lot of soldering? Is he a ceramicist? Does he eat a lot of rice? And he should get himself checked with a provoked metal test, which is complicated enough. You can have him give me a call, doctor to doctor. I will talk to him, and you can reach out to AskDrDon.com, and he can reach out to me, and I'll call him, because I would help any fellow doctor any way I can. Okay. The last thing I want to talk about is diabetes. Just for the audience, diabetes causes the blood vessels that feed the nerve to the little tiny blood vessels get blocked, and the nerve doesn't get what it needs, and it dies back from the tips. And that's why diabetics get peripheral neuropathy, and it's very irreversible in Western medicine. But actually, it is reversible, but you have to take very, very high doses of certain nutrients, and you have to work with a doctor who knows what they're doing. I've also found that I can really mitigate the discomfort of it by using a certain technique in acupuncture about half the time, and it only works half the time, and I have never figured out who's, so I just have to treat people and see if they get better. We've come to the end of our time, Miss. Ask DrDon.com, and I tell him to reach out to me. I will give him the lowdown.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for calling. We have run out of time. We'll be back with more next week, so please tune in. This is Dr. Dawn wishing you all well. Stay safe, wear your mask, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDon.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDon. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.